There's only one thing better than drinking an ice cold whiskey sour on a hot Alabama night, and that's telling the truth. I know what you think about me, Grandma. You think I'm worthless. You think I'm a stumble bum who ain't never gonna amount to anything. Well, old woman, you are wrong. And if there's only one thing better than telling the truth, Grandma, it's listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. I'm your curator, Devin Decker, and joining me, as always, my curator 2, Sejan Sarawick.
Hi, Devin. Of course, happy to be here again once again on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe as we partake of yet another part of the original six of Adam Sandler's films.
Yes, the original six, not the ridiculous six. That will be for later in this journey into the unknown that is the Sandlerverse. And Sejan, I would like to take a moment to apologize for calling you Curator 2. I'm sorry, being folksy and whimsical and foghorn leg hornish, it really just kind of killed my improv ability, which is why I think I'll drop this particular character.
I wish you would, because this is from last week. I don't know why this character came along for the ride.
Oh, well, I think we're going to find out as we delve deeper into Little Nicky. Little Nicky, 2000, the year 2000, in the year 2000.
Everything changed for Adam Sandler. Yeah,
everything did change for Adam Sandler. And in this installment of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we're going to look at this film and see exactly what that means. What it means for everything to change for Adam Sandler. But before we get there, we start out every episode with our, you know, we establish what we're doing here. We're here to chart and be the cartographers of our own interpretation of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe as it stands currently, as of 2021. Who knows? They could release Billy Madison 2 next year, and then it might throw everything off.
Considering his Netflix deal, it could be tomorrow.
That's a good point. So what we're here to do is we're trying to, build that map with what currently exists, and we have our fingers crossed as hard as they can that there isn't a film released, you see, just not wrong, tomorrow on Netflix that just tips the whole pudding out onto our feet. And see, tips the pudding out. That's a idiom I have not heard in some time, perhaps because I've just made it up.
You know, a little bit about, like, how this film kind of stood for us and then and now. I have to say that, like, I think I said this very early on in this project. This is definitely, in my mind, the, like, definitive moment for Sejan to really kind of start to, like, question his fandom in this universe, to really kind of reflect on what I've been doing with my comedy watching self up until this point, and to really kind of try and decide if this is where I wanted to keep going. Watching it for today was, I won't say a chore, like, excited to watch it just so that we could talk about it, but I was of a mind, let's put it that way, when I was going into this movie. And the movie, I will say, short spoiler for my feelings on this going forward, but, like, it doesn't do much to get you out of that funk, but it does something, and we'll talk a little bit more about it. There's still something to this movie. But Dev, I gotta say, I've been very surprised at how excited you have seemed to be to talk about this film.
I gotta tell you, I'm right there with you. Little Nicky came along at a time in my life where it didn't hit. And the reason why it didn't hit is because it felt like a greatest hits. I've talked about Little Nicky being described and really watching, like, this greatest hits reel of every Adam Sandler film that came before it. And when I saw that at the tender age of 13, it kind of, you know, for, you know, I guess appropriately, since we're discussing a film like Little Nicky, I forsook Adam Sandler because he had forsaken me. Yeah. And it's because up before this, I used to sit on my little computer in the basement listening to What the Hell Happened to Me and They're All Gonna Laugh at You and Stan and Judy's Kid. And I would just play computer games in the basement listening to these Adam Sandler CDs on repeat just all the time. Like, that was my life. That's what I did.
I was one of those kids that wasn't allowed to own those CDs, but anytime I got a chance at a friend's house to put it on, like sleepovers and stuff like that, that's what we did. Yeah, so like and Adam Sandler CDs is definitely many a night in my youth.
So then this film comes along and I see it, and it really feels like he wasn't doing anything new. And the person who had originally introduced me to Adam Sandler, he introduces me to Kevin Smith. And for a time, I latch onto the Kevin Smith train. And I don't know what got me back on Adam Sandler, but I will say, prior to rewatching Little Nicky, this is kind of where I stepped off. What got me back on the Adam Sandler train was Grandma's Boy, when I worked at Hollywood in 2006. And there's a lot to unpack there, but today we're focusing on Little Nicky. And what I'm like happy to report is that watching it with fresh eyes and like new, like trying to treat it new, like not let that impede my viewing, I realized that Little Nicky may be the first real masterpiece of this journey.
Okay. All right. That is a fucking stance, my friend. All right. Well, yeah. So, I mean, let's get into it. Let's talk about this movie. First of all, like, you're not the only one that felt this way. I mean, as I mentioned, I also kind of, this was when I stepped off the train, but this is kind of when the world stepped off the Adam Sandler train for a little bit. Like, this is his first official flop out of all of the films that we've talked about. Cost $80 million to make, barely made $60 million, and that's taking in worldwide gross and included. So, you know, like, obviously not when people talk about this, besides us, they only ever care about America, right? And so it was even worse then. Yeah, man. So like, this was it's weird because I almost said the word misstep, but I think that it's not a misstep. And I think maybe this is where you and I are going to at least find some common ground. I don't know if I would still call it a masterpiece, but I will say that I think that it caught a lot of heat in the year 2000 that in retrospect, we had no idea what was happening with cinema at the time. And so like, we didn't know where things were going in terms of this kind of comedy. And I don't just mean Sandler comedy. I mean, you know, the irreverent, slapsticky, almost like skit to skit style comedy that we still get. I have to say that this definitely has risen to the top over the years for me in a way that at the time it really felt like it was a sinker. Let me stick to the metaphor. but yeah, what do you want to do first, Dev? Do you want to break down what this movie is all about before we get too deep into that sort of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, if those are, yeah, I think that let's do the synopsis. I want to get the synopsis out of the way. Cause I feel like if you know what this movie is about, you're on a good pace to understand why I find it to be such a masterpiece, and maybe a masterpiece completely out of time. Like, did Little Nicky happen too early? I think so. But
I was going to say too late, but yeah, let's talk about it.
Ooh, that'll be interesting. But here's the synopsis without any further ado. Little Nicky, the titular protagonist and youngest offspring of the devil, has a problem. After 10,000 years on the throne of hell as the Prince of Darkness, Nicky's father has decided to name his successor. And in a turn that shocks his older brothers Cassius and Adrian, the devil has chosen himself as the next ruler of hell for another 10,000 years. Disappointed in this development, Cassius and Adrian decide that they are tired of serving in hell, and that they will go up to earth in order to create their own kingdom of darkness to rule. Their actions have an unintended consequences of sealing the gate of hell, making it so no new souls may enter, effectively killing their father if they don't return in 1 week's time. Thus, the task of retrieving his brothers from our world falls on the unlikely shoulders of Little Nicky, but he's never even slept alone in another guy's house, let alone visited somewhere as big and scary as Earth. After taking a mulligan on his first visit due to a train-related injury, Nicky is assigned to Hodegos in Bulldog's clothing, Mr. Beefy, who is prepared to guide him through the perils of living on Earth, lend a paw in the recollection of Cassius and Adrian, but most importantly, spread the gospel that Popeye's chicken is fucking awesome. Beefy has arranged for Nikki to live with the aspiring actor Todd in the East Village while he is on his pilgrimage, and soon Nikki is on the hunt for his usurper siblings, the only problem being that they have the ability to possess the living and could literally be anyone, anywhere in the entire city of New York. After a fruitless day searching for his brothers, Nikki passes out in Central Park, where he is found by John and Peter, two would-be apostles that witness him being robbed by a shady street vendor. Nikki pursues the thief and gets back more than he expected when our leading lady, Valerie Varan, steps up to in his defense against the mugger. Nikki begins pitching woo, but is rudely interrupted by Adrian, who derails his advances and then, ironically, murders Nikki with a bus. Nikki returns and Mr. Beefy tells him the only way to defeat his brothers is by learning how to harness the darkness inside himself, which leads Nikki to discover Cassius is masquerading as the referee of the strangest Harlem Globetrotters game that Todd has ever seen. Nikki rushes to the game and, using his newfound powers, is able to defeat Cassius and trap him in a magic flask. In so doing, John and Peter pledge their allegiance to him and join the cause. Now with the full party assembled, Nikki can begin the task of capturing Adrian, but it will take the return of Frederick Peterson, a cameo from Ozzy Osbourne as a Pokemon, and Nikki learning the truth of his maternal lineage if he hopes to succeed in his quest.
Woo! All right, man. Yeah, always, as usual, congratulations. Yeah, man. So it's that classic tale of, you know, demon boy sent to the surface to save his loving father, the devil, who is actually very loving in this film, and falls in love with a girl and learns that he's part angel and saves the universe. Really fucking weird story for a Sandler universe. And maybe that's where this starts for me. There's a level of absurdity to Sandler films that we have talked about since day one, right? Like, since Billy Madison, we have talked about the idea of absurdity. The second that you see the giant penguin, you know that Sandler is doing a very different type of comedy. And I believe, I'm paraphrasing, but the director of that film, she said that she didn't get the script at first for Billy Madison until she realized, just go with it. Like, it's just think about it like a kid at play. And that is what Sandler movies really are watching Sandler just playing. And I'm fine with that, right? Like, I can go with that. And then you see, you know, Happy Gilmore and Waterboy. Like, there's a level of absurdity and surrealism. There's always, though, like a definitive line before things get too crazy, right? So, like, in Billy Madison, I'm thinking, like as silly as the rest of that movie is, it's not as silly as the musical number that's at the end of the second act, beginning of the third act, right? Like, that is the silliest that movie gets, and it's only for that moment, and then boom, snap back to reality. Happy Gilmore, there's the times when he goes to his happy place is like maybe the weirdest that it gets, right? You know, and like in this movie, it's flipped. It is. Let's take that weird, surreal world and make that the real world. And so, in the story sense, hell is really kind of the reality of this film. Earth is the kind of the fake reality that Nikki just kind of visits from time to time for silly shit to happen. But other than that, like, hell is really kind of like where it's at in this movie for me. And I think that that's where it starts to kind of have a lot of really weird cracks, because in order to allow that. First of all, I think the movie needed like 30 more minutes to build like actual structure. This is one of the thinnest stories that we've seen so far. Like, it is boom, boom, boom. Things just happen in an instant. Like, you mentioned like the idea that his father decides that he has to decide who's going to run hell for the next 10,000 years. Why? They don't even pull out a book or point to a scroll or anything like that. We just are told he's going to make this decision. And then he fucks it, or he doesn't fuck it. He says fuck it and just picks himself again. So clearly it wasn't that big of a decision, except apparently it was so much that the brothers leave. And then the brothers leaving somehow leads to hell shutting down, which is a great concept, except we never see any consequences for it other than their father getting sick. You know what I mean? Like it's not like on Earth, like we start to see like bodies piling up. We get to see things going crazy because the brothers are doing stuff on Earth, but not because hell is closed. You know what I mean? Like there's no weird mention of like, hey, nobody's died for a few days or anything like that. You know what I mean? Like there's no consequence in the real world to that part of the story. It's just weird that there's no there's not even an attempt to really kind of just explain some stuff in this film in ways that there kind of was in the other movies, that like it starts to kind of lose some of its luster for me.
See, now, everything that you say, this movie is a masterclass in subtext. And that is the wrong thing to do with a comedy. I will be the first person to admit that in comedy, as in most entertainment, but specifically comedy, you show don't tell. And not even like at the broadest term of show don't tell, where the showing could be them reading a book and saying, you know, every 10,000 years, the person on the throne of hell must change, right? Showing us that. Showing us that there are consequences of the gates to hell closing and that nobody is dying. But instead, what Little Nicky does is masterfully knit this huge overarching plot structure in the subtlest ways possible. And I understand that if that's not what you signed up for, and it's an Adam Sandler film, so that's not what you signed up for. And I get that. I understand that. But it works for me. Because the whole, it's been 10,000 years, why does the ruler of hell need to change? Adrian and Cassius, when they're so upset that neither one of them gets to take over as the ruler of hell, talk about the fact that it's been 20,000 years in hell, and then we meet Lucifer, played by Rodney Dangerfield, and he must have ruled for 10,000 years. And as we all know, if you, and this is the other thing, I know a lot about theology. I've studied a lot of religion because I'm like, maybe I want to do this. And then no, I realize that it's just like any other fiction out there in the world. And that might be an inflammatory statement, and I apologize up front. But when you've read all of the books of worship, you start to see them as nothing more than Harry Potter. That was even more inflammatory, and I apologize. But having that structure in my mind, you know that Lucifer, when he got to hell, he didn't have a plan. God didn't give him a plan. He just cast him out of heaven. So he was always kind of flying by the seat of his pants. So there are no fast and hard rules about how hell functions. The 10,000 years on the throne is just because that's when Lucifer, in this universe, in this telling of the story of heaven and hell, decided after 10,000 years, I'm done with this, and gave it to his son, played here by Harvey Keitel. So then it's just assumed that after another 10,000 years, Harvey Keitel would be tired of doing this job and would pass it on to one of his sons. But there are no hard and fast rules in hell. And that's super important because the lack of rules in hell is why when Adrian and Cassius decide to leave through the gates of hell and they seal, that's playing by the rules of Catholicism and the fact that Jesus, God sending his only son to earth, is what closed the gates of heaven until he was able to come back and break them open and shepherd people from Sheol into the afterlife of heaven.
Yeah,
So like
but like that, but that doesn't work for me. You don't get to say there's hard and fast rules here, but not here, and not explain them to me. Like
and
it's
I
great that
get
you have this background. Nobody else watching this movie did, and that shows. Like that's the thing, is like this shows in the ways in which this movie was received, is like for the first time people were just like, oh, I can't do it. I can't defend this movie like I could the others. You know what I mean? Like there's nobody rushing to this movie's defense in the year 2000. Like there was, like there would have been for films before it. And it's a shame because like it's great that like this kind of thought and stuff is in there, but that to me is bad script writing.
I get it, but I will say this, right? Even though we're audio, right? We're not looking at each other. I could kind of feel you going slack-jawed and dopey-eyed as I gave my explanation of why this plot works for me. But as a child, seeing Little Nicky alone, which I can't wait till we get to the fact that this is rated PG-13 somehow, watching it alone, once the gates of hell closed, I'm like, oh, like when Jesus left heaven. Like it was something that worked for me even then. And at 13, I had far less knowledge of the rules of religion and the belief system that existed. So, like, that happening and me, like, kind of making that connection, they were hoping a lot from their audience. And
yeah,
I think
but okay,
that,
so why does Harvey Keitel's devil start falling to pieces? Where
because,
is that in the Bible?
Because no new souls. I mean, to be fair, the difference being God left heaven in the vessel Jesus Christ, right? Because Jesus Christ, while being the Son of the Lord, is also the Lord. That's the Trinity aspect of Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
So God was not in heaven to deteriorate as no souls could enter heaven.
Oh, I'm sorry. Does it say that he would have otherwise?
No, we don't know that. So what they're doing... So here's the aspect. Anything that exists on the side of heaven has these hard and fast rules that exist because we have the literature in our real world. Anything in hell, they get to do whatever the fuck they want because the rules of hell are a lot less stringent based upon the literature written about them.
Except clearly they're not, because there's all of these weird rules that come into play where suddenly, like, souls are not allowed to leave. Harvey Keitel's devil starts falling apart. I don't know. Is he given a name besides devil?
He's just the devil.
Yeah,
dad.
Right.
He's credited as dad.
Yeah, right. But like, so there are. So that's what I mean. Is like, is I don't want to sit there and play like theological, like deep study while I'm watching this movie. That's not fun.
Well, it's not fun if you don't have the theological background, I will grant you. But I, sitting there watching the film, and the subconscious trolls in my brain putting together this much deeper plot, I was so deeply invested in Little Nicky right from the get. Because of just...
You know what? Well, you know what does a much better job of playing that exact game that you're talking about to an audience that doesn't understand it?
You're going to say Dogma, aren't you?
Which came out a year previously.
Yeah.
This is them just taking their shot at a Dogma. I swear to God, Quentin Tarantino, who shows up in this film as the blind preacher, I think somebody told him he was going to be in Dogma, and he showed up, and then like a year later, came out of like a Coke craze and was like, wait, which one was I in?
I actually think that Harvey Keitel showed up on set to replace Dustin Hoffman as the devil, and Quentin Tarantino came with him. And they're like, I guess we can put you in the movie. And people call his role as the blind deacon a cameo. Quentin Tarantino is a full-on character in this film.
He's a character. He has three scenes, all with lines. He is a character in this movie, yeah.
Friggin' Apollo Creed is a cameo. Quentin Tarantino's blind deacon character, he is the real fucking deal in terms of a character who exists in the film.
But, like, so to your point, that there is a lot of, like, theological fun being had here that is actually super intelligent, I'll grant you that is in the soup, but it does not taste like that. Whereas, like, Dogma, that is highlighted in the soup. When I take a sip, I know, like, that's the kind of fun that I'm having with a film that came out not a year earlier. So they're being beaten by a film that's already existed. So I'm sorry. Like, it just doesn't work.
I mean, I did say that after this... I took solace in the Church of Kevin Smith. Like,
yeah.
It makes sense why that became the place that people went. That comparison to Dogma must have existed, and it's where people went after the weird animal that was Little Nicky. Like, I cannot remember watching this as a kid, aside from that moment being like, oh, I guess the gates of hell are closed because the son of the devil left. Like, that's the memory I have of this film. That's about it. So this
there are two things I remembered about this film. It was boobhead Kevin Nealon in the moments that he gets them. I did not realize he showed up as much as he does with boobs on his head for the rest of the film. And the other thing was the Popeye's chicken scene. The very first time Popeye's chicken is fucking awesome when he's sitting there in the blue jacket for the first time on the park bench. Those two scenes are the only scenes I truly, honestly, like, retained about this film. And was still, and part of it's what fed some of my concern going back and watching it, is unlike the other ones that I could quote, you know, most of back to you now, even, like, this was one that I was just like, I remember not even loving it when I was a teenager, so this is going to be a weird one. And, like, I don't want it to sound like I'm really crapping on this film. I'm pointing out that there was there was a stark difference between this film and those that came before it. It wasn't just that people got sick of Adam Sandler, it's that there is something in this movie that is different that people didn't want at the time. And I think now in retrospect are actually okay with. And that's where I come back around on this film, is because the thing that people were kind of against in this film, the kind of this doesn't feel like the rest of Adam Sandler's movies, like feeling that you get from this movie, I think we've settled into being okay with that now. It was just at the time such a hard hit because even The Waterboy had been such a huge fucking deal. Like it was kind of hard to watch in that sense of like, this isn't what I want right now. But like I said, I need to be fair and say, like, going back to it, I'm okay with it.
I mean, for me, this was a completely new experience. And I really dug a lot of the stuff that they did. I mean, the fact that Peter Dante and John Lofgren are like apostles of the son of the devil
Fantastic.
is brilliant. The fact that
Oh.
their names are Peter and John, but I think that they might just be playing themselves.
Yes. They save this movie's not the right term. They turn this movie, my way of viewing this movie around completely. I literally have a note on my second page of notes that just says the cake scene is all of the promises I was told about this film. And then, like, I kind of stopped taking notes after that. I have three or four notes after that, versus everything before that is a page and a half of just written down notes about this film. So, like, that scene with the two of them and the reefer cake, first time that we actually see drugs, or at least reference drugs in a Sandler film, right?
At
Am I
least in the
wrong
ones
about
that we've watched up
that?
to this point.
Yeah. Right. Well, like, so within the Sandler universe, it's the first time that drugs are fully acknowledged, despite the fact that we've had theories about them being there the whole time. But there is a. There's a bong reference in Waterboy. I should point that out, but it's like said as like a thing. And but this is the first time that we see like Adam Sandler's character ingest it. Yeah. So from that point on, like the rest of the movie, I'm like, okay, this is the movie. Like I'm in now. So it's like, oh, that's what I'm saying is I needed kind of like a half an hour more, just plugged in, kind of mostly in the beginning of this film, sprinkled the rest throughout, but like really kind of beefing up the lore of this world. A la like a Dogma, where you have like, I mean, like, you know, I needed a Chris Rock, I needed a Selma Hayek, I needed those characters that had the story to show up and really kind of fill me in, and that never happens. But by that point, where the two of them really kind of fold themselves into this story, by that point, I at least have a semblance of a world for me to latch onto, and so like, I kind of want to just watch their movie.
And I get that. They are two of the strongest characters in this film. And we don't get a lot from them either, other than the fact that they fucking love the devil. Like that's it. That's their entire character arc. So then finding Nikki is like, that's all they've ever aspired to in life. Finding
Yes.
the son of the devil and being able to pledge their allegiance to him, that's all they ever wanted. And
Because
that's what
of
they
rock and
get.
roll. Like let's also point that out though. It's like that's the other like weird place where things are a little thin for me, is there's so much in this movie about the devil that is like surface level, everything your mom's afraid of about the devil is true. And like I don't know if it's satire or not. You know what I mean? The idea that Nikki and John and Peter are way into fucking Ozzy Osbourne, and like Ozzy ends up being, you know, the spoiler alert, the deus ex machina of this film, right? Like that. The thing is about Ozzy though is that our parents were always wrong. Ozzy was not a dude that worshipped the devil. That wasn't even part of his shtick. It was just assumed he was because of his presence, his oeuvre. Like so to lean into that, but not give me a clue as to whether or not you're leaning into it because you think it's funny, or lean into it because everything your mom told you was true. Like it's a weird kind of, for lack of a better term, I'll use a current one. It's a very boomer view on the devil. His entire movie's like a joke about hell is like just boomer joke after boomer joke about hell.
I mean, a very important distinction is made early on in this film, in that sitting on the throne of hell as the Prince of Darkness is not about torture. It's not about committing acts of evil. It is about making sure that there is a balance between good and evil in the world.
Yes. Yes, and I love that line, and then it kind of dies on the vine. Like you see it in Nikki, so I get where it goes, but like again, it just comes down to just say it more. Like I'm here for the fun and the popcorn of it. Like I don't want to be sitting back and parsing out like the weird subtle like imagery and lines of this film. Like I want them to be on the fucking nose more in this movie, that I don't know why they aren't, because so many other things are on the nose.
You're not wrong, but it, I mean, you're, yeah, 'cause that's a huge part of the plot of this film is that like it, what Adrian and Cassius want as ruler of hell, Cassius wants to torture people all the time. He wants to turn it into a pit of torture, and Adrian wants to, he just kind of wants power. The brothers really, in this other cool subtextual way, represent the seven deadly sins, with Adrian like being gluttony and pride, and Cassius being wrath, and it's wonderful. It's this other wonderful thing. But every time I point out something that's subtextual and really adds to this film, I feel you twisting a tiny knife in my side, being like, that's the problem, Devin. The problem is that they should have made it more blatant.
Right, like it's not even that I don't like these elements that you're bringing to the table. I love these elements, but I think the problem, all right, so for normal audiences, let's admit for a second that you and I and anybody listening to this is probably not what we would consider a normal audience for a film, right? A lot of people don't go in wanting to bring something to the table. They're expecting the film to set the table and serve them, right? Like that's the idea. When you go to a piece of art, it is supposed to present an idea to you and bring it to you. And I think it's only really been in the last like 10, 15, 20 years that we as a people have really kind of started to consume things like video games, movies, and television in the way that you and I do, where we say, well, yeah, this is it is serving you this, but if you bring this to the table, it changes the whole meal. And it's like, oh wow, that's fun, that's exciting, that's great. And if they're trying to do that, when they may be, I'm not going to say that they aren't, because you're clearly like there is a lot going on in this film. They're so far ahead of their time, and this maybe speaks to what you were saying, that they're not doing it good enough for me. You know what I mean? They're not inviting me into the movie in that way that you kind of barged into this movie. Like, right? Like you broke into this party. You crashed into
Oh
this party,
yeah.
right? In a
In
way that
a Kool-Aid
I
made with holy
didn't.
water, baby. Yeah.
Yeah, like you know what I mean? It's not that these things are not there. It's not that you can't parse this stuff out. Clearly it is. It's that at the time that this movie is made and the ways in which they are making this movie, there's nothing informing that type of viewing for me as an audience member. If I was, again, anybody else besides the two of us ripping this movie apart right now, right? And because of that, it fails. And I'm not saying it fails, like look at it, laugh at it. I'm just pointing to the numbers and saying there's a reason this movie doesn't succeed. It isn't the box office smash that The Waterboy was. And it's exactly this. Is I think you're pointing to the problem, is all of these little subtle things, but at the same time, it's also doing dick and fart jokes. It's doing boob head on Kevin Nealon jokes. You know what I mean? Like it's doing Michael McKean picking his nose jokes. And I'm not saying that it can't do those and this. It's just gotta do it right, and this movie doesn't.
I can get behind that. All right. I think that we've got a nice baseline to jump into my favorite part of this show. The
Yeah.
part I look forward to every week, because the synopsis, that's some work on my part, but this is all play. So let's go into something new, something old, something borrowed, and something blue. I wish I had a music sting there. All right, Sijin. So I don't want to steal your something new. I have a
Okay.
couple, so I'm going to let you go first on this topic.
Okay. Yeah, no, I'll go first. I was trying to think if it made sense for me to go first, because what I'm about to say is going to really kind of turn my whole, this is my eating the cake scene. This is going to turn kind of my whole view on this film going forward and like the conversation from my side going forward. But what this movie does, and the reason that it didn't work, I think, for people at the time, and the reason that it only works for me in retrospect is because Sandler was willing to make a change in himself and in this comedy that was subtle but noticeable. His ability to adapt to the current zeitgeist of PG-13 family level comedy as throughout his career going forward, this is the first time we see him make that kind of pivot. Because the PG-13 family style comedy that ends up kind of bombing at the box office, the other side of that story is this movie ends up winning a ton more money on the back end in fights between USA and TBS and all of these places that want TV rights. So Little Nicky famously or infamously bombs at the box office, but the reason that New Line sticks with him as co-producers on a couple more movies going forward, they do Punch Drunk Love and Mr. Deeds, if I'm not mistaken, but the reason that New Line is still willing to stick with him even after this huge bomb, and the reason that he's able to continue being the kind of weird like money-making juggernaut despite the fact he might not make it at the box office, is because movie, TV, and DVD distribution rights are huge for Sandler films, and that sticks. And that is because Sandler is able to make movies that people still want to watch, own, and be a part of. Even when they're kind of meh on them, people still kind of want to watch them, you know, while they're out at a bar. People still want to watch them with their friends while they drink. People still want to sit around and just turn their brains off for a while. And he learns to ride that particular wave, and it carries him through the rest of his career comedy-wise. And this is the first time that we see him willing to sacrifice anything to kind of just make a movie he knows that everybody's still gonna be want to be a part of, even though they might not like it. It's a weird thing that it's the reason that we look at Adam Sandler for the Adam Sandler cinematic universe and not fucking like Norm Macdonald or anybody else that's like trying or even Rob Schneider. Let's keep it in the family, right? Like the idea that like we don't look at those guys and the comedies that they made the same way that we look at Sandler still. And I think it is this exact attitude that makes this film. It is his ability to adapt to the comedic like zeitgeist of the time for this particular style of film that kind of makes us all hate him but love him. And this is the first time we see it.
I get that. I like that. Sandler becomes self-aware in this moment. And we talk about how he understood things before, but I think him becoming self-aware of the fact that he is a robot, this is a dangerous time for Adam Sandler.
Well, and what's weird is like he clearly understands that he's going to start making comedies that are not going to do well, because this is also the first movie where we see him really, really buy in to the what's the word I'm looking for? The on-screen bullshit advertising, the
Product placement.
product placement, right? Like it's not that it wasn't present earlier. I mean, the joke in Happy Gilmore with Subway is beautiful, but that's just it, is he does it intelligently, and it's that one thing. In this, I wrote down, you've got Kmart, you've got Popeyes, you've got Coke, you've got the Globetrotters. I mean, the Globetrotters, God love them, they're not a basketball team, they're a marketing
I
entity, they're
know
an
they don't
entertainment restaurant.
televise Globetrotter games, but
Well,
it's
or they do,
still
but you have to pay for them on like pay-per-view, like
yeah.
when they're special events, right? Like you pay for the Globetrotters. Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, I mean
But
it's you're not wrong. That product placement is so big, I felt the need to put it into the synopsis. I needed to give those shout outs because it's so ingrained in what this film is.
So hit me with your list, Dev. I want to hear your
Which
list of
brings me
his.
to it. So on that meta level, what this brings to the universe is this is the first Sandler movie that we've looked at that has a video game tie-in.
Oh. I love
And
this.
that
I'm very
is
excited by
Little
this.
Nicky on the Game Boy Color, which like it boggles my mind that it's a Game Boy Color game. I tried to play a little bit of it. Unfortunately, I was able to find a copy of it and get it in just too late to like actually complete it, but I got to play it. It is the sloppiest of licensed video game junk, which
Nice.
is very disappointing, especially because it starts out with a fully, like, not digitized, because that's wrong, but graphically interpreted opening with John Lovitz climbing the tree and doing the speech about, "Hello, Mrs. Dunleavy, why don't you get into those sweats?"
The pervert bird, yeah, fuck me, Jesus, that scene is okay,
That scene is,
man, I
we're
can't.
gonna talk about that scene a couple more times before NOB borrowed.
Yeah.
NOBB is over. Trust me. But yeah, fully like graphically recreated with him then getting killed by Scotty Dunleavy and winding up in hell and being attacked by the giant bird with Kevin Nealon as the, John at the gates, St. Peter at the gates, being like, "Welcome to hell." The full thing is graphically rendered, and then there's the whole scene where Harvey Keitel chooses himself as the successor. Like, some real work went into graphically reinterpreting this game.
What would you call it? 8-bit, 16-bit? Like it is, but it is on that Game Boy level of animation, and I love that they do this much of the movie.
It's so much of the movie, and you know who all the characters are. Like, they're very. I'm looking forward to playing through the game a little bit more, just to get to these scenes again, because I can't imagine that it's just gonna end once I'm out in the world. And when you die, right, when you lose all your energy, you're greeted with a cutscene of Harvey Keitel's devil slowly losing parts of himself. It's impressive. This tie-in game. But then the
Yeah.
actual gameplay is running and jumping in horribly cluttered graphical messes, and all you can do is walk and jump. Like, up to this point, I've gotten through two stages. I don't have an attack yet, so I don't know what else I can do in the game. But also, final just addition is that Tithead, Kevin Nealon's character, he is also represented with his full big fake titties on his head in graphical form. It's insane to me. So we talk about him like skirting the line and understanding the family-friendly PG-13, but this feels like that self-awareness puts him into the video game atmosphere. And it's strange, right? Like, we talk about the senility of everything. That's a very 80s thing to have the licensed game attached to it. And that's what they're doing with Little Nicky.
Yeah.
And it's that appeal, it's that global appeal. The other new thing, and this is in universe, is we added witchcraft with The Waterboy. This film really shows that there is a light side to magic. Everything we've seen before this could very easily be contributed to a black magic or a witchcraft or voodoo, similar
Yeah.
things. This introduces the concept. I mean, like, we see Chubbs in heaven in Happy's Happy Place, but this confirms that Frederick Chubbs Peterson is in heaven. And
There
it's
is a
still
heaven and
all in the
Chubb's in it.
hips. Yeah. So,
Yeah, man.
heaven and hell exist.
It identified, yeah, it solidifies the idea that this is a that in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, heaven and hell are real places. People go there and come back from there. And on top of that, that means that magic has a definitive grounding in this.
Right. And that is, I don't know. I mean, it's another double V movie, right? It's Valerie Verán. So if we're only looking at the double V's, if that's all we get through, that means something. That speaks to something about the Sandlerverse as we interpret it as these wayward pilgrims.
And I think is like some of these other rules that we have brought up, like I think really come into play here. My favorite one is to this day is I love how much I never really thought about how important family is in all of these stories. And I mean like that is full on in display in this film. You know what I mean? Like the whole relationship he has with his father is kind of amazing actually for what that character could have been in duller hands. Like and that was entertaining. And like the brothers and him fighting with them, but also like his relationship in the few scenes, the one scene we get with his mother is also really interesting in the ways in which like he's so happy to have found her. There's no animosity between them despite the fact that like he's never known who she was, didn't even know that she was an angel. Like there's a beauty to that. And then I adore the ending where she's looking down on them in hell, and he kind of knows that she is. So Harvey Keitel's devil looks up at Reese Witherspoon and has this beautiful moment between the two of them. I enjoyed all of that. So like yeah, like there's I have no doubt in my mind that this fits into all of the rules that we've made so far.
Excellent. Which brings us to old. And, you know, as I let you go first, I'm taking this one. And if I steal yours, I'm happy about it. It brings the peeper, what's going through his head? Wow! To the screen. In the fact that John Lovett's whole opening sequence with him as a horny bird in the tree, peeping on Mrs. Dunleavy, and then Scotty Dunleavy taking a life, which is kind of the hardest thing about this film to take, is that that little boy killed a man.
Oh, my exact note is, fuck yes, Scotty, nice work. Picnic pervert is what I called him at first, because I didn't know what he, like, anything else about him, except that he carried an entire fucking, like, pillow and picnic table up there, picnic basket, I mean, up there with him, with, like, fucking glassware and champagne, and so I called him picnic pervert, and then my next note is, nice work, Scotty, fuck yeah, like...
And I mean, the peeper, that's from Stan and Judy's Kid, right off of that comedy thing, bringing that character of Adam Sandler front and center at the opening of this. And if we're talking about the peeper, this is the first time that we see Whitey Duvall represented on screen, played to perfection by Dana Carvey.
Oh, amazingly by him. Yeah, man. So my something old is something a little bit deeper in the DNA, right? And that is that we have seen this so far in every one of his films, but everything that Sandler really touches is that struggle within one person between good and evil. And in this movie, it is present within Nicky for sure. It's also the crux of the entire universe. Is this fight between good and evil, and the fact that just because of who you are, where you come from, what you do, none of that makes you evil. What makes you evil is like your actions in the moment, right? Because we've seen plenty of good guys become bad and bad guys become good and things like that. But there's this whole idea with Nicky in that he is good. Like, you know what I mean? Like, even when he is doing, like, some pretty messed up stuff, like, when he is trying to find his inner evil, and, like, he always apologizes to people and things like that, it's very... There's something on display in this film that I feel like Sandler is always trying to strive for with his characters, and that is to find just that asshole that you love. And whether that's he's an asshole because he's an idiot and you love him and despite his stupidity, which, you know, is its own form of assholery, I think, in some cases. But there's also in his dad, in the idea that, like, his dad's the devil, but his dad is also pretty fucking chill. Also, granddad is not the worst. He's like Rodney. We haven't talked about Rodney Dangerfield playing the Lucifer of this movie.
Podcast, he gets no respect.
But like, to my point earlier that there's not enough like deeper lore going on, and you pointed out like the idea that, like, you know, that 20,000 years really says something. Like, then give him more screen time to talk about it. Like, you have Rodney Dangerfield in what is one of his last roles on screen. I think he only does two or three things after this. In fact, I think the majority of what he does after this is voice work, and it's not good voice work. I'm getting onto a whole different. That's a different podcast. That's my Rodney Dangerfield podcast. But you have him in this movie, and he's just fun.
Yeah.
He's not evil. He's not a dick. He's not mad at anybody. Like, he's just happy to be there. And in fact, has one of the best moments at the end with Harvey Keitel and the fucking Hitler move at the end.
Shoving a magic flask up Hitler's ass.
Oh, man. Yeah. But that struggle of good versus evil within one guy, and how that's kind of what's always on display in his films. And this movie just blows that out to be like the whole story.
I dig that. I dig that a lot. There was something about Rodney Dangerfield that you said that I wanted to revisit. Oh, I mean, that speaks a lot to, and I know personal preference, right? Especially with how I approach religion, where I think that, like, the best type of religion is the religion you write for yourself. I like that the interpretation of hell in this film is that Lucifer just didn't want to be God's servant anymore. And so he got cast out to hell, and he kind of got to build his hotel with blackjack and hookers. Like,
I want to see the movie where Rodney Dangerfield plays Lucifer getting kicked out of hell, right? Like, yeah, man. Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. But I dig that. And that's why I like that there are no hard and fast rules about what hell are in this film. And you keep bringing up things that just remind me of why that's so wonderful. And that
Yeah, I just
brings.
wish that there were less rules. But before we get off of Rodney Dangerfield, because I fear we won't come back to him because the poor guy always gets forgotten.
No
But I do want to
respect.
point out that this isn't the first time we've brought him up in this podcast, because we mentioned with Billy Madison the idea of like that is the thing that like Adam Sandler clearly is latching onto, is like back to school and stuff like that, right? And so I think that it's really cool just to see Rodney Dangerfield being in this movie after he was so clearly an influence on Sandler early in his career. So to have him be in this movie, I can only imagine must have been a fucking treat for him, right?
Right. And I think that also ties into the fact that Nicky's relationship with dad of Harvey Keitel as the devil, that really is very reflective of the relationship that Billy Madison has with his father in Billy Madison. This, like, they clearly love each other. It's just the idea of what they're able to do as the offspring and in this world. And it's very cool to see these continuing themes, these things that make it a shared cinematic universe. What do you got for borrowed, my big boy? I'm sorry.
No, it's yeah, I was willing to go with it.
I just like
So I kind
alliteration.
of I touched on it earlier, and it's the idea of the holy comedy, right? Like, so Dogma is the thing that like I really kind of gave this movie shit for, because Dogma came out a year earlier, but it's not like Dogma invented the idea of the holy comedy. You have stuff before this. You have Oh God, You Devil. You have our favorite that we've talked about before, a thousand times, Bedazzled, which, funny enough, the remake of Bedazzled is in theaters at the same time as this version of, Little Nicky. Like, there was a version before, but the remake version of Bedazzled with Elizabeth Hurley and Brendan Fraser. I
I thought
always
you
I
forgot Brendan Fraser's
no
name,
no
and I'm
no
like,
I'm naming her first because she owns that fucking film.
she does own
But
that movie.
the Harold Ramis remake of that film, right, is in theaters, I think, for like 6 or 7 weeks before this one. It's also not doing great, I should point out, but it's out there, it's in the water. But yeah, so like, but long before that, the Dudley Moore version of Bedazzled, or the Oh God, You Devil series that we get with not Richard Murdoch, what's that dude's name?
Dudley Moore.
Dudley Moore is in Bedazzled, isn't he?
I'm pretty sure he's in
No, no.
Bedazzled.
Yeah, I know. I'm talking about Oh God, You Devil. It's
Oh, God, You
the
Devil is George Burns.
George Burns. That's who I was trying to think of.
I
Thank you.
thought you were talking about Bedazzled still. You said
No.
Bedazzled, you got me thrown off. This is not the Say Report. It is not the time for Brendan Fraser History Month, but you
No.
threw me off because you mentioned Benny Frage, and I'm there.
But like, even on TV at this point, we've had like the idea of the funny stuff that touches on the churchy thing, right? And this movie is really heavily leaning into that sort of attitude. And I think in that kind of irreverence is the right word whenever you're talking about Sandler films, and like the irreverence to making Lucifer fun. You know, like the idea that the devil is a good dad.
The
Like,
devil's
right?
just this
Like,
guy, you know? Like, yeah.
yeah. And I think that I think it's all really borrowing from those kinds of things that we've kind of played with already in this realm.
Great. Because for my borrowed, I have just biblical epics in general. Yet your Ten Commandments, your greatest story ever told, really
Never.
anything biblical that happens, like just straight up. This is the type of it's borrowing from that. It's borrowing from that in the wrong way, come to find out for your general audience. But if you're somebody who actually knows what all of these stories are about, or like the Bible really well, you're able to see the connective tissue that they borrowed certain themes and ideas from, which is wonderful. But at the end of the day, it's a comedy. It's a comedy that's supposed to have mass appeal, and that's not the greatest way to appeal to the types of people who are going to see comedies. And the types of people who are in Sunday, who are in church every Sunday, are not really the target audience for this movie about the son of the devil.
Right. No, I mean, there's literally a scene in this movie in which a church gets invaded, and they get it, it's honestly one of the better scenes in the first half of this film, because you have George Wallace play amazingly playing the mayor of this of the city of New York. But yeah, there's definitely a level at which it tries to point its finger at the Bible and like poke holes in it. as you've been saying, like this is kind of it is looking at actual theological things that happened and then like using it for fun and play, but like it doesn't work for an audience that's way into the Bible because it's offensive to them, and it doesn't work for anybody that's not into the Bible because they don't get it. So like this movie is literally for Devin.
Yeah, I got like I weirdly feel I've never I didn't even feel that way about that. There are times where there's like a joke or something on TV and I feel like that was made for me, but the more I thought that Sijin would be of the same mind with this film, and the more I talked to him about it on this episode, the more I see that no, there might have been like one person who was the target audience for this film, and it may have been you, Dev.
But then they gussy it up in a bunch of like fucking jokes about like Popeye and Meatball running around with a funny voice like
It's
I
actually Meatball's dad.
Is it
It's
really?
Meatball's dad. Yeah,
Oh.
Mr. Beefy is Meatball's dad. And I guess so. Then one other thing, because I don't want to just say all holy movies in general. A big trope that this film borrows is that if there's going to be a supernatural or paranormal event in New York City, like 9 times out of 10, they booked it for Central Park. And that makes me think that like the reason why we didn't build anything on Central Park is not that nice, thoughtful reason to have a place where there's trees and such in the city. I'm sorry, historians, but I'm not buying it anymore. I'm thinking that there's something underneath that park that one day we all gonna have to deal with,
The
and we
restaurant
should
on the
be
green is
preparing
actually
right in.
just like a doorway to another dimension, and they're serving people. Like, it's definitely happening. Yeah, man, I love any time a movie wants to make New York a character, and this movie definitely goes out of its way to do that. Like, this movie could not be the thing that it is if it wasn't New York City. They could try LA, but that would be just. I guess LA would give them more excuses for more celebrity cameos, but like New York has this beautiful like weird surrealness to it already as like a fantasy like place and also kind of hell on earth, and like so I really do dig that that's where they choose to set this, and it's probably why so many supernatural epics I guess I'll say choose New York as their setting.
Right. And also, we saw if they had chosen LA with Bedazzled, but that's another story for another time and another podcast. I don't think we're going to be talking much more about Bedazzled on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. But, promise for the Say Report, right? And we always keep our promises on the Say Report. Which brings us to our Something Blue. Something Blue.
You
This
want to
was
go first on
very
this, or do
easy
you
for
want?
me. Oh, I'm going to take the first one on
Yeah,
this.
go for
Because
it.
you always derail it, right? Because Something Blue for me, it's Nicky's coats. Primarily that baby blue parka that he is so obviously wearing when he first meets Todd and on the cover of the DVD and in all of the marketing. But then he also has a really nice royal blue jacket that he's wearing when John Witherspoon mugs him. So, like, Nicky's jackets are my something blue for little Nicky.
Yeah, man, it is pretty iconic for this film, I have to say. My Something Blue for this movie was it has to end up being Clint Howard as Nibbles, right? Like it has the cross-dresser character in this film. It's the one thing that just doesn't it doesn't have the like the love behind it, because anybody out there that wants to be offended at something in an Adam Sandler movie, I'll give it to you. Like there is offensive stuff in his movies, and we have had discussions about things that could be perceived as offensive, but why we don't, things like that. But if you want to say that you were offended by the portrayal of Bobby Boucher, I can't take that away from you. That is it's hard for me to ignore that. This is the first thing that like this is the only thing, sorry, in this particular movie that I'm just like, man, like this is the thing that kills me, because there's I can't I was thinking about other things that may or may not be, but really this it's the thing. It is the only thing in this movie that is really kind of upsetting to me, is this portrayal of this character, this cross-dressing character played by Clint Howard. And like there's a couple of moments when the character first shows up where I'm just like, they're playing it for laughs that it's a guy, and in drag, and that sucks. But at the end of the day, he's respecting this guy, and like even the second time he sees him through the window, they have a perfectly normal conversation, and so like that's cool. But man, later on, it's later when they use him as the butt of a couple of jokes in the third act of this film that it really drives home that they just it's just rude.
Yeah, when Reese Iffens points him out as things you've never seen before, well, maybe not as bad as that. Like that is the thing that hits hard. I mean, you're not wrong, because I'm sitting here being like, well, Seijin, Nikki respects the character, and they have perfectly cromulent interactions between the two of them. But you're not wrong; it does descend to a very strange and insulting level for that character. And going along with your definition of the word blue, which I swear someday I'll get, I'm sorry. I'm too focused on the jacket, Seijin, or the duck, or the cool blue water from an icicle, from a glacier. That the gay panic in this movie in general, like we've
Yeah, the
mentioned
way
it before. Like,
that these the roommate is treated is definitely something to point out as well. My only thing backing away from that and pointing at Clint Harrod's character here is just because of how much more offensive that is. But you're not wrong. The ways in which the gay panic is present in this film
right,
and
but
throughout the 2000s, kind
well,
of
yeah, and
reflective of the
throughout the
time. It's not an
2000s.
excuse. It's me wagging a finger at the whole time
And
period.
the 90s leading up to it, like it's not something good, but I feel like the fact that Clint Howard's character is played as a joke, it's just a deeper extension of that gay panic. So like if it were just that scene where Nikki's like has no problem interacting with him, he's like, I'm looking for Valerie, and they do, and he's like, you got the wrong window again, like those would be fine if right before it, you didn't have the, yeah, all right, Liberace, all right, this and that, like all of these
Well,
things against Todd
and then the
that.
two converge in the final moments of this movie when they're doing the Animal House style ending, which I could have easily stolen for the Something Borrowed, by the way. But the Animal House style ending where we get the backstory on what happened, or I guess post story on every character, right? And that Todd does a one man show and only one person shows up, and then the joke is it's Clint Howard's character, and it's like, haha, right? This one character that you've been like playing the gay panic card the whole time. Oh, and the other card you've been playing the gay panic card. Let's just bring them together and just one big masterclass of it at the end.
Yeah. Like, that's the reason why, while Clint Howard is obviously the most offensive style of comedy in this, especially the jokes that they play it for, you can't downplay the Todd stuff because it is weirdly a part of that whole thread of DNA in this movie that is
You know what is a
reflective
good
of the
joke with
time
Todd?
and, ugh.
You know what is a good joke with Todd though? And I am going to give them credit for this because they fuck up so much in the ways in which they interact with him. I love the Almost Famous shirt because Almost Famous was still in theaters when this movie came out. That shows how quickly they put this movie together though. Almost Famous had been in theaters for, I believe, oh, I actually probably have the number right here. Hold on. Yes, I do. Almost Famous had been in theaters for 9 weeks at the nope. Yep, 9 weeks at this point. So the fact that they somehow pulled that fucking t-shirt out and threw it on him is nuts.
Yeah, it's great. It really, Todd is another one of those characters where there's like a beautiful subtlety to the fact that he is an aspiring actor. He is not an actor. Like
Yes.
that's very nice to see. And Todd also, he has some of my favorite moments. I mean, when he's like, I've always wanted to kill
Kill
someone.
yes,
Like
yeah, man.
it's
That moment
so.
when he turns to the camera is terrifying and
Yeah.
awesome and hilarious.
Like Alan Covert, the reason why of those three people, Alan Covert again showing up in an Adam Sandler film, like really the MVP of the like not SNL cast members who will join the Sandlerverse over the years. Like he's so good, and there's a reason why he plays Todd and not Peter Dante and not John Lonergan, because he is able to bring the subtlety that character requires. And him also yelling at Kevin Spacey, knowing what we now know about Kevin Spacey, is like just chef's kiss, like moment, like.
I have to say that like this is late enough in the movie making process, and the three of them, John, Peter, and Alan, all being with him for these movies, that you have to imagine this role was written for him, right?
Oh, especially with Stephen Brill being the director. Like, yeah. Yes.
All right, man. So yeah, so those are something old, new, borrow blue. So I got some other stuff that I definitely want to like point to. But is there anything like major? Because the rest of my stuff is just like little things that I think we should not ignore, but
I mean, we haven't really talked at all about Valerie Varane. And just the fact that she's a really tragic character, in a weird way, she's the most tragic of the leading ladies that we've seen in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe up to this point.
what is your definition of tragic here? Let me ask you to clarify that for me.
Her backstory, she like when she's like, I realized at a young age that I was nothing special, so I went into design so I could create beautiful things. Like my heart goes out to her in this way that I did not expect at all.
Yes, but I do want to point out, still kind of fits my favorite, another one of my favorite things about these movies that we've noticed. She still fits the mold as a strong enough female lead that she doesn't need Nikki, and we see that very specifically in the scene in which she beats the ever-living shit out of him when he's flying up to her. Like, she pepper sprays him and then literally punches him in the face so he goes flying back like 10 feet. So like, she and I do think that she is, out of all of the females that we've spoken about so far, and I suspect going forward she will kind of stay in this slot for me. She's kind of at the lower end of that though, because she does end up needing Nikki to save her in the end in a way that others have not necessarily needed yet. And I think that kind of speaks to what I was saying about one of my biggest issues with this film, is of it being the thinnest of the Adam Sandler movies we've watched so far. Is it is so willing to fall back on just known tropes and understanding of like movie making, that the female character gets dangerously close to being that damsel in distress for the entire movie.
I think that they do a pretty good job subverting it. And the reason why I bring up that she's a tragic character is to highlight that fact that despite having kind of a shitty father to be like, you're nothing to look at, and the way she's found a
Kind
nice
of
way to
a
look,
shitty father.
yeah, a shitty
She had a
father.
shitty father.
Yeah. She found a really nice way to interpret that and have a strong place in the world. And that's wonderful. That really works for me. And then the fact that she is a damsel at the end, it would speak more to being a problematic ocean if everybody who's helped Nikki up to that point were not also being held at the same time. Like, it's not
For
she is
sure.
being used because of the fact that she's the girl that you like, Nikki. That does happen at the very end, that you'll get in the flask because if not, I'll hurt her. And that stinks, right? But it's right up until that moment. Like everything else, it's like, no, you helped my brother try to take me down. All of you will have to pay for this. Like if it were just her who's being dangled over the lava, problem. When it is Peter, John, Todd, and Mr. Beefy all being wedgied over the slime from Ghostbusters 2, that works for me. And also, it's not Nikki coming in and bringing them down. It's Henry Winkler after being covered in bees doing it.
Exactly. Yeah, she's not saved like hand in hand by little Nikki. Yeah. No, it's not necessarily that I feel like they don't subvert it. It's that they don't subvert it as well with her as they do with every other female that we've seen so far, every other female lead we've seen so far in these movies. And like I said, I feel like she's, unfortunately, is probably going to stay at the bottom of that list for me in terms of in those terms, because I feel like going forward, they don't treat their character. They're smart enough to learn that lesson from this movie. We'll see. I might be proven wrong,
We'll see,
but yeah.
right? I don't know. I'm already like thinking about my arguments for the next movie, and I'm excited about that. That's what I want this to be. I want this to be an electric thing, the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And when I already have synapses firing, you got me excited, Sijin. So thank you for that. That's the real big one, is just giving that shout out to Valerie Varane, who also, I mean, it's Patricia Arquette, like, who who goes on to be huge, winning Oscars and all of this, and like I forgot that she was the one who played the love interest in this, because she's kind of only there because these movies have a love interest. She's also not as substantial to the plot as Veronica or Virginia or Vicky Valancourt. Like, it's weird that she's a double V character when you consider
No, I mean,
what
this
they've
all
meant
speaks
in the
to.
past.
Yeah, I mean, this all speaks to what I said, is that I feel like she really kind of, she is the weakest link in the female leads of the Sandler verse, and it's not fair, because we are playing with a, I mean, we are playing with some pretty strong, like, actresses and characters and all that sort of stuff. So, like, in a lot of ways, the movie's just kind of doesn't do her the favors that it should. Like, and so it's not anything on Patricia Arquette playing this character. It's that I feel like, as a character, this is just not the strongest female lead that we've seen or will see.
It also really speaks to Little Nicky being just a greatest hits victory lap film. Because, in that way, that those characters are given the double V name in the three films that we've examined before this one, I feel like there's a reason why they get that super heroic alliterative titling. Where in this one, it feels like it's only happening because we're going to be making all of these other references to what came before.
For sure, for sure. Yeah, man. I mean, Little Nicky doesn't do anybody any favors. I mean, so, like, Little Nicky, like just to give a little bit more history on the film, because I just did so much, like, digging into this, because it was hard not to. This is the movie that gets the dude that's running New Line Cinema at the time fired. Like, he loses his job. Michael De Luca is the guy that loses his job because of, to be fair, a combination of Little Nicky, 13 Days, and then Town and Country, the Warren Beatty, Gary Shandling comedy. You remember that one? Nobody does.
I remember it happening. I've never seen it.
So 13 Days is the JFK Bay of Pigs story, right, with Kevin Costner in it, that famously had like three different directors like walk out on it. He had to like call a friend to come and finish it so they could get it out on time. Town and Country is another one that famously started out as like a $14 million indie comedy, which, you know, say what you will about indie in the 90s, but like indie comedy, and then like blew up to like a $45 million film because Warren Beatty and Goldie Hawn signed onto it for some reason, supposedly because Michael De Luca, right? But then, like, Michael De Luca is also the guy that gets thrown out of an Oscar party, a pre-Oscar party. He doesn't get to go to the Oscars one year because he gets caught like receiving oral sex from like a hooker somewhere, and that's not fair. I on the female's part, because I don't know if that's the full story. That's just like the rumor, is that she was a paid escort of some kind, and he gets caught like engaging with her somewhere, and he gets thrown out of the Oscars before they even start. And like that happened 2 years prior to this, and that didn't get him fired. And then suddenly Little Nicky comes out, and it's the nail on his coffin.
Oof.
like that's where this movie kind of stands in movie history, is it's up there in New Line's kind of year of shit with the year 2000. And they kind of don't recover for a few years after this. Like, they kind of sign on, as I said, with like Adam Sandler, they just kind of finance projects, but then like Sony handle the actual production of Mr. Deeds and Punch Drunk Love and stuff like that. And there's other instances of that throughout their kind of little cluster of actors and directors that they work with, where like they kind of end up not really doing well for a while. And so like Little Nicky kind of rests at the head of that. And I don't know if that's fair or not, but that's what we're looking at. Little Nicky's also in like the really bad luck of going up against some like really fucking hard-hitting comedies at the time. I mean, it comes out a week after Charlie's Angels, a comedy action film that is just fucking gangbusters. Even years later, is still a phenomenal watch to go back to. Like it and I think Meet the Parents is out at the same time as Little Nicky. Like there's a whole bunch of stuff going on that way.
I mean, that's interesting too when you consider the Drew Barrymore of it all with Charlie's Angels. And if, I mean, Dustin Hoffman, then it goes on to be in Meet the Fockers years later, but like he was supposed to be in Little Nicky. So it's interesting. It's just interesting to see that the slight threads in the entire cinematic universe of cinema that this film has.
So it really does kind of become a victim of its time for a lot of reasons. first of all, like the world of film is changing in this moment, but also the world is changing in this moment. And like, and that's why I said that one of the things that's really cool is that this is kind of where Sandler, I think he sees ahead. I think he realizes where things are going, and so he kind of leans into a much simpler film with Little Nicky than we've seen him do with the other three. It's very easy to get this stuff down onto a page and then pitch it to a movie producer. I mean, like, fuck, they hand him $80 million, and you see where it goes in this film. I mean, the sets are amazing, the costume work is super fun, the CGI doesn't hold up, but at the time was pretty rad, right? Like, I mean, people being pulled out of noses, Harvey Keitel falling apart. Like, also all of the actors that you see show up, even just for a couple of scenes in this movie, they all got to get paid. But like, he gets some actors in this film, right?
Yeah,
I
this feels
mean,
like the movie where the cachet of being in an Adam Sandler film has to be at its red hottest.
yeah, and
Like,
then it falls on its face, which is kind of a bummer. But it doesn't slow him down, and like, and I think it speaks to the fact that he knew that this was worth making at the time, despite the fact that it falls on its face, because he's able to then ride it out. A lot of these people just keep coming back to him to keep making movies with him.
very true. You mentioned something in there. Oh, the CGI. That spider scene, I had forgotten about it, and I was kind of impressed when it happened.
I like the scene. I have to admit, it's still fucking reboot style CGI,
Oh, it's goofy, but it's fun.
but yeah, it was very fun. Yeah.
But the practical work, I mean, I always will shout out good practical work. The tits on Kevin Nealon's head, they look real.
Well, and like, and Fuzzy Friend there, what's his name?
Gary
He
is
has a
his name
name.
in the movie.
Yeah,
Or is it
Gary
Jerry?
is.
It's Gary or Jerry.
Gary the Monster.
Yeah.
Gary the Monster is a phenomenal, fun, like, puppet character to have on set. Like, and
Yeah.
like, yeah, man, there's some good
And the
stuff.
stuff with Harvey Keitel where he's like just limbless.
Yep.
Like that's some pretty good stuff. And like him ripping off his finger and the
Mr.
stuff there.
Beefy. There's a couple of moments with Mr. Beefy where you see that they used a practical puppet. Like, I'm thinking of the shot of him in the strip club getting waterboarded with champagne.
Yeah.
Like that is a practical puppet that was very, very silly for that moment. Yeah, man, there's you can see where the money goes in this movie. It is not surprising to me that it costs this much, and like, it doesn't feel like it just went to pay a bunch of Adam Sandler's friends. Like, it actually feels like he was trying really hard to make like a fantasy comedy movie here. It just doesn't work in a lot of ways.
Right. And I think one of the biggest ways is that trying to keep it to 90 minutes. Because you're not wrong. 30 more minutes to extrapolate on the things that I like weirdly saw in the in between the lines of this
Yeah.
film would have gone a long way, and I think other people enjoying this feature. Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. I feel like I had one other thing that I wanted to mention, but
I got a couple of things here that I
yeah,
should
you
point
go,
out.
because if you're doing that, I think I can
First of
find.
all, we should point out that this movie, it kind of speaking to what I've been saying, is that Adam Sandler saw the future with this film. How prescient is it that he is taken down by a deep fake?
I wrote the same thing. Thank you
Yeah.
for jumping on
Yep.
that. Yeah, that
Oh,
deep fake is
man.
so good, especially because it's freaking Al Pacino, and we're gonna get to
Well, he
him
has that awesome
eventually.
line. I love that line. Is that's that dirty cockroach?
Dash that
Joey
dirty
Buckley.
cockroach.
Oh, fuck, man. Yeah, first mention of drugs, and we had talked about that. I really like the subway plan to catch Adrian, where he slips inside John, I believe it is, in order to catch him down in the subway. They go in for the money, and then and it's when they're in Michael McKean, or when Rhys Ivins is character Adrian is in
Adrian,
Michael
yeah.
McKean. But yeah, it, like, legit good plan to catch him. And yeah, it fails because of one detail that he couldn't account for. And like, yeah, I very impressed. Just I thought that was really I thought that was really good.
There is the best subtlety at work when he hands him the flask in the paper bag, and John covers the flask with the paper to take his sip, and then Peter does not. It's like this great moment of like, oh my God, Nicky is in John. That's the only reason we wouldn't just pretend to drink. Like, that's what I'm talking about. There's these weird attention to detail in this movie that every single one of them just made me squeal with joy.
The last note that I have here, it was a note because this movie, did pull a good cry out of me, and one that I've greatly appreciated. Can you guess what it was?
I'd rather hear it, 'cause I cried too, but I just want to hear it, Siege. I
The
want to live in it.
one line fucking joke after this movie ends, where they show his mom talking about how things did not work out between his mom and dad, amicable split, all that, and she goes on to end up dating her long-term aerobics instructor,
Chris
Chris
Farley.
Farley. And that got me. Like, I laughed and then realized I wasn't laughing. I was actually kind of tearing up. It was just a beautiful thing that like that I think kind of speaks to the ways in which Sandler, like we've talked about this, and it's actually in our rules, the ways in which these movies are not about him making movies to make money, to make more movies, to make money. He just likes hanging out with his friends and filming it. And that's really all this is his career has ever been about. He's just lucked out in that that also happens to make him hundreds of millions of dollars. And like, you know, you see him admit to this in later projects. I mean, I've pointed to Funny People a thousand times, but like he is like really like open in that film, in that like it was always just kind of about just doing these things that he liked doing with his friends, fucking around on the weekends, and they've realized that, you know, if we filmed a couple of these, we could make a buck, right? And it just spoke to that like Chris Farley, how near and dear to Sandler Farley really was, that he gets this shout out in this film for him was just a great moment.
It's also perfect, the whole aerobics thing, the callback to
Yes.
SNL, like that
Yeah.
one final fuck you to Lorne Michaels. It's
Yeah.
nice. It is nice. Which brings me to my last thing, and that's that little Nikki is the Little Mermaid. Like, unapologetically, it is the Little Mermaid. And it really became clear to me at the very end when the devil's like, "No, your place is up there. It's not down here with us. But I'll never be with you again, Dad. That's all right, Nikki." And I'm just like, this is the Little Mermaid. This whole movie, the damn Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
Mr.
Yeah.
Beefy, he's Sebastian. Also, we haven't said their names, and they deserve all the credit. Two more RIPs. Tiny Lister as Cassius. Like, it's really, I love when he gets to act, right? As good as he is as Debo in the Friday films, and I love him in The Fifth Element, like, he is just chewing up the scenery as Cassius in this film.
He steals that entire scene in the Dark Knight. Like when he shows up in the Dark Knight, that scene becomes about him. Like it's fucking crazy that he gets to work with a director like Nolan as one of his final films, and like he steals that scene.
Yeah, so like what he just gets to have fun in this film, and it's great to see. And then John Witherspoon, I mean, I mentioned him briefly, but like, as the guy who robs Nikki, and then like, "Oh, you want to give me the crazy eyes?"
Another Friday alum, by the way. But
Yeah, exactly. That's like, it's just, it works, and it works in such great things. Also, I think there's an Ice Cube song in it, right? If we're gonna talk Friday references, this is the
Oh
first
man,
song.
that was one of my early notes that's just so far back I forgot, but the soundtrack of this movie fucking rules.
It's kicking. I mean, it's a little bit more Incubus than I would prefer. I'm just not a big
To be
fan of
fair,
Incubus.
it's a lot of Incubus like guitar riffs, but then it never gets into the songs. The song always ends before they actually get into it.
That might be why I'm okay with it, 'cause it's the singing of Incubus that, like, I'm just saying all the inflammatory statements today. I really like, if we're going to talk about sound cues before we get into the rules of the ASCU as it currently stands, the use of Power Man 5000's When Worlds Collide.
Yep,
Like,
yes.
it is like, we're gonna take the two parts of this song that exactly apply to what's happening on screen, play them, and get the hell out of Dodge. And it
Yeah.
works magnificently.
So also Laces Up, Marino. But
That's a
the
different movie. Why would
that's
you
it
do that?
that's also a different show. That's a Save Report joke. But yeah, so to kind of roll into the new rules, I'll be honest, one of the other big reasons that I was kind of down on this film is that like I don't feel like it moves the needle too much in the cinematic universe, Adam Sandler cinematic universe. I will say though, my one note, and we kind of stomped on it earlier, but I'm happy to revisit it, is it does it does for real and for sure define that there is a heaven and a hell to the cinematic universe. That magic is once and for all definitely real. And on top of that, there is good magic, bad magic, there is heaven, hell, there are angels, there are demons, that sort of thing. So like it solidifies that.
Yes, very true. I will say this film introduces the actual devil as a character, and his two mothers were fire dragons, offspring Cassius and Adrian, and Eric Gordon is still the most evil person in the ASCU for me.
It just kind of really, really, really runs that point home. For sure. No, man, I'm with you.
Oh my God. Like Eric Gordon going to the lengths to try to take over the Madison Hotel Group. Like Adrian and Cassius, when they're denied what they thought was going to be their inheritance, the way that Eric is, they decide to go out and make something of their own. Like
Yeah, it's not even in their intention to fuck up things in hell. They don't I don't think that they know that what that them leaving is going to lead to that. They just don't care when they find out, right? Like it's never implied that they knew that was going to happen.
Right, that stands a lot with the whole there are no rules to hell because no one bothered to write them down, Sijin. We have more laws for the ASCU than Little Nicky's hell has for itself.
Yeah. For sure.
But yeah, that's the thing. Like, it's this weird thing where Eric Gordon is still this just immoral jackhole, even in the face of actual demons, because they somehow have their a moral code that he is just lacking. And I don't want to keep turning that knife on him, but it's just so true. I'm sorry. They want to establish their own thing, and that is so important to the drive of the story, but also understanding them as characters.
Yeah, it's not that they turn on their father, they just decide to leave him.
Yeah.
It's a very different motivation than Eric literally turning on the father figure that we're led to believe Madison is in his life, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
It's.
yeah.
I don't know. It's just very weird. I mean, that's really it, because you're not wrong. This doesn't really. The biggest move in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe that this does is confirm, in addition to a hell, there is a heaven. It's not just something that Happy imagined. Chubbs
Well,
really
and
did speak to him
yeah,
from
right.
heaven.
Or like going back to the Waterboy, where she is like really in fear of the devil and making sure that he doesn't go to hell. Like she actually has something to be worried about for her boy. It actually kind of justifies some of the weird behavior of Kathy Bates and the Waterboy.
And considering the townie, Rob Schneider's character, appears as the exact same character in both, the townie now is a law of the ASCU.
There you go.
There's no doubt that at least Waterboy and whatever this movie is, Little Nicky exist in the same pod.
Right?
They
And
exist in the same.
Happy Gilmore, right? So like this is, I mean,
And
that's the other
yeah.
thing. We didn't really tip our hat to, but this was kind of the movie that really set this in motion for a lot of people, the idea of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. Yes, Hubie Halloween was the thing that like kind of got everybody talking again and kind of led to us doing this thing. But even when we started this show, we admitted like we've known this since Little Nicky. And like this movie does really, yeah.
It
So let's give it
really.
that. It's the linchpin.
This is the linchpin. Damn, Little Nicky. And Seijin doesn't like you.
Yeah, it has been my least favorite so far. This is my attitude has not changed since we started recording this, but I still stand by the fact that in rewatching it, I have actually found a lot more joy in it than I thought I was going to.
You know what I didn't touch on? And this is important. Nicky is not dumb. And that is. One of the biggest things that I believed about this film was that Nicky was dumb. He's just a dumb character. And it's just how my mind had framed it. But his really only downside is that he was hit with a shovel by Tiny Lister and it gave him a speech impediment.
I mean, I told you his plan to catch Adrian in the subway station is pretty fucking awesome. Like it's a very well thought out, very cool plan, and like works really well in the structure of this film. Like it's a it, yeah, no, dude, Nicky is I think he's up there with Happy on that side of the scale in terms of like intelligent but definitely flawed. In this case, he's flawed due to kind of a lack of confidence put into him by toxic masculinity of his brothers and some of it coming from his father babying him. But yeah, man, the Nicky is a no Nicky is a strong character in and of himself.
Yeah. And I mean, like, he has interests, and he's like, "Dad, I'm putting together that mixtape, Monsters of Metal, for you." Like, he's not dumb. And for the longest time, I thought that little Nicky was dumb, and that was supposed to be part of his character. And the longer we are in the Adam Sandler universe, I guess the more I'm acclimating to the fact that, like, all of these characters, despite having these, like, interpretations and like ideals in pop culture as being stupid really aren't. And I think that is one of the other reasons that Adam Sandler really strives and survives in popular culture, is that he's okay with creating characters who will do stupid things, but at the end of the day, they're not inherently like some fantastic level of stupid. And that's important. All right. Anything else that you want to put on paper before we move on to the next one?
No, let's move on. Let's keep going down this rabbit hole. We're
All
getting
right.
close.
We are getting close to the first six being done. We've almost looked at all the double V's. So next up, we are going to be looking at Pixels, right? I still can't believe I got
I
Pixels
keep
into
forgetting
this
about it,
first
to be
six.
honest, because yeah, man, like let's do this. Okay, we'll talk about it more next episode.
We will talk more about it next episode. So, if you want to do the homework, check out Pixels. My guess is you probably haven't seen it. And if you have seen it, it could use a rewatch. I watch it every year. I am so happy. And also, I somehow made it that like it's next month, so my April rewatch of Pixels, I can double bill, baby. Getting paid, coming and going.
You plan that.
Of course I did. What am I, not Devin Decker? All right. So, in the meantime, if you have anything that you want to get in touch with about your feelings about the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, you can tweet the show directly. We are on Twitter at the ASCU. And if you'd like to talk to Sijin about your favorite Adam Sandler character, you can find him on Twitter at Siege versus the World.
And if you have played any of the Game Boy game for Little Nicky, reach out to Devin Decker because you two will have something to talk about
Right.
at Devin D. Decker.
Right. And if you enjoyed this brief respite with us talking about the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, you can find us every week at our podcast, literally about everything, The Say Report. All right. So until next time, just remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Good night, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to AdamSandlerCinematicUniverse@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.